Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of four episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
So what's President Trump up to? Does he want to take down the Republican Party and remake it in his own image?
I don't believe anyone doubts the American people's values or the commitment of the American government or the government's agencies to advancing those values and defending those values.
And the president's values?
The president speaks for himself, Chris.
Hello and welcome to TrumpCast, the show about the man who was begging Vladimir Putin for help with a Moscow real estate deal while running for president in 2016, Donald Trump. I'm Jacob Weisberg. Today on the show, are Trump's cabinet appointees looking for an escape hatch? This weekend, it sure looked that way. No less than three of his most senior appointees, his secretaries of state and defense, and the chairman of his economic council, challenged the president's disgusting comments about the white supremacist rally in Charlottesville. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said that the president spoke only for himself. Now, usually, you'd say something like that if you were about to resign or expecting to be fired. But T-Rex and his colleagues may be placing a different bet here, that being associated with Trump's toxic views and incompetent management is a lot worse than having Donald Trump mad at you. Or they may be predicting that Trump is now just too weak politically to fire them. Or they might be predicting that Trump himself is on the way out. Or some combination of the above. It's not quite take this job and shove it, but it's getting closer to you're not the boss of me, which is not something that a president who expects blind loyalty is ever going to take well. I'll be back in a moment to discuss Donald Trump's no-confidence vote from his own team with The Atlantic's McKay Coppins. But first, let me remind you about our live show coming up in Austin, Texas, on Saturday, September 23rd at the Texas Union Theater. It's part of the Texas Tribune Festival, and we've got not one but two special guests, Jill Abramson, the former editor of the New York Times, and Joaquin Castro, the congressman from San Antonio. It's going to be a great show with me, Virginia Heffernan, and Jamel Bowie. Tickets are available at slate.com/live.
Hey, TrumpCast listeners. Jason here with just one more quick message before we start today's show. We're trying something new here at TrumpCast, a mailbag show. Do you have questions for our hosts, Jacob Weisberg and Virginia Heffernan? If so, ask us by tweeting at us at RealTrumpCast, or you can use the hashtag AskTrumpCast. You can also leave us a short voice message at 646-598-6510. Again, you can tweet at us at RealTrumpCast, use the hashtag AskTrumpCast, or leave us a voice message at 646-598-6510. We'd love to hear from you, and we look forward to answering your questions on an upcoming show.
I'm pleased to welcome back to the show today McKay Coppins. He's a staff writer at The Atlantic. McKay, hello.
Hi.
I think last time we had you on the show, you were at BuzzFeed. How are you liking it over at the Palmier climbs, I guess? Now it's like you, instead of writing seven times a day, you just write an article every month citing Emerson, right?
Yeah, that's right. We sit around in our tweed sport coats and debate grammar and philosophy all day. It's very nice.
Well, that's what I want to do with you right now. Actually, I wanted to ask you about whether Trump's cabinet is revolting. I know there are two meanings to that term. That was intentional. But there were the last couple of days, there have been just a series of extraordinary comments from his Secretary of State, from Gary Cohn, the head of his economic council, and from his Secretary of Defense, as well. And I guess before we get into the specifics, is there a phenomenon here? If you'd asked me who are the Republicans who are going to start to desert Trump, I would have said, well, it'll start in Congress. I would not have said it would be his own cabinet appointments.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, I will say there has been a kind of very gradual uptick in members of Congress being willing to criticize the president. But it's much more striking that people like Rex Tillerson and Gary Cohn, you know, top aides and advisors in his administration, are willing to criticize him. And I think, you know, I don't know if this is part the beginning of a broader trend, if it's just kind of the fallout from Charlottesville, but it does raise questions about how tenable the Trump administration is as it's currently constructed, at least. I you know, if top administration officials are willing to go on the record and criticize the president or undermine him or distance themselves from him, it's unclear the extent to which the president really has control of the federal government, even in his own administration, his own White House.
And you could say these guys are speaking from conscience, and maybe they are to some extent, but they're also making a political calculation.
Of course.
And the political calculation is that the president being mad at me is not my biggest problem. I may have a bigger problem if I don't create any distance from his comments on Charlottesville at the moment. And so it looked to me like all three of these guys were trying in some way. They're not trying to leave. They're trying to figure out how they can stay and still maintain both some self-respect and some public respect.
Right. And I think that exposes a couple of things. One is that I think there is something, you know, you can call it conscience, you can call it perspective, you can call it political calculation. I think there's just a growing sense within his White House and administration that this presidency is turning out to be a pretty huge failure. And not just in, you know, in the, according to the metrics that I or you or people in the media would set out, frankly, they haven't achieved any of their own conservative policy goals. It's unlikely that they will in the next year. And it's possible that we'll get through the entire Trump presidency without a serious major legislative accomplishment. Meanwhile, you have things like Charlottesville illustrating the fact that this president is not ever really going to change the way that he acts. He's unpredictable. He's volatile. You could say that he's reckless. And I think some of these guys are starting to wonder, you know, how do they want their line or their footnote in the history books to read? And some of them, I think, are starting to put distance between themselves and the president. And maybe they're even kind of leaving open the possibility that they get fired over it. But they kind of feel like they can speak out and let the chips fall where they may rather than continue to be seen as the good soldier at moments of ongoing crisis and controversy.
Right. I mean, if you don't think he's going to be there for 4 years, and several of them are certainly behaving as if they don't believe that, you don't want to be the last person there. You might be better off being fired in an earlier stage. I mean,
right.
You know, you want to be on the right side of that without being able to predict when it's going to happen. Let's talk about Tillerson first. I mean, I was amazed by his comments on this Fox show to Chris Wallace over the weekend when he said the president speaks for himself on Charlottesville. I mean, that's an amazing comment. I mean, that was very clearly distancing himself from the president and saying the president doesn't speak for the administration, doesn't speak for anybody except Donald Trump. I mean, that is certainly, if you're talking about pushing it, you could get fired for saying something like that in most administrations.
Oh, absolutely. He was saying that the president does. It came after kind of a very boilerplate spiel that kind of any secretary of state probably would give about how no one in the world doubts the American government's commitment to promoting, you know, democratic values, et cetera, et cetera. And then the follow up is, well, what about the president? And he says the president speaks for himself. That not only puts the president on the wrong side of American values, it also completely undermines him and kind of suggests a certain impotence to, you know, saying that the president really is speaking for himself. He's not in charge of the American government, certainly doesn't speak for it. And you can kind of just ignore him. I think that was a remarkable display of kind of disobedience or lack of respect. And it was clear, I thought, watching it, that Tillerson went in ready to say that. He had that ready to go. You know, when Chris Wallace, you know, asked him, what about the president? He said, the president speaks for himself, Chris. That seems like a line he went in ready to deliver. And he, you know, so far there's been, he hasn't reaped any consequences. So who knows, you know, we're talking just 24 hours after that interview. It is possible that by the end of this week or the end of next month that he won't be in his current job. It's unclear to me right now.
You took that as a sign that he may be planning his departure or expecting.
Yeah, he's planning his departure, or he sees the writing on the wall and knows that he's not going to be there forever. And again, like I said, just wanted to kind of plant a flag and go out with some dignity.
There's been some mounting frustration there, right? I mean, the White House has not let Tillerson fill all these senior roles at the State Department, and they've undercut him on policy on point after point. I mean, they've made pretty clear that, you know, policy is made by Trump on Twitter, not by the Secretary of State in a policy planning process.
Right. And then we saw a report from Axios today just saying that Trump has gotten more and more fed up with Tillerson. And the quote that was featured in that article is Trump saying that Tillerson was too establishment in his thinking and he doesn't get it. That suggests that both Tillerson is unhappy in the job. We've seen lots of reporting about that. And Trump is unhappy with the way Tillerson has acted. I've been kind of, you know, this is a side note, but I've been kind of struck by how strange Tillerson's tenure has been as Secretary of State. It's one thing to have kind of clashes over foreign policy, which is certainly unusual and not normal, but also understandable given Trump's very unusual foreign policy and not entirely coherent foreign policy vision. But it's another thing that Tillerson seems entirely, at least for the first few months of his time in office, entirely obsessed with kind of restructuring the State Department as an organization, which is, you know, interesting, and maybe there's some merit to it, but is not really the primary job of the Secretary of State. There's a lot of fires to put out around the world, and when you have a Secretary of State who has a very underfunded, understaffed State Department who's kind of fiddling around with the seating chart, that doesn't speak very well of how Tillerson is handling his tasks.
And then let's talk about Gary Cohn. So Gary Cohn, his top economic advisor, on Friday had an interview with the Financial Times where he was very strong on Charlottesville. He basically said Trump has got to do a better job condemning these alt-right groups. He, you know, he used the term neo-Nazi. And then on top of that, he was overheard in a restaurant in the Hamptons, which I appreciated was called the Frisky Oyster, because he was feeling a little frisky himself, saying the president can't keep his mouth shut. And when you're trying to make policy, you can't even tell the president what policy you want because he'll just blab about it. I mean, it was essentially saying you've got to, if you work for this guy, you know, you have to treat him like a loaded gun and just try to do what you can to prevent catastrophe.
Yeah, I mean, geez, the Gary Cohn remarks are pretty devastating. And there's a difference, right? The caught in an unguarded private moment, bad mouthing your boss. You know, we've all been there. With the substance of what he said was kind of remarkable. That basically, they have to treat Trump like a problem to be contained rather than the leader of the administration of the country.
You think that was an accident? I wasn't there, but that struck me as maybe very crafty to be talking very loudly in a very public place. So you're not really responsible for comments, but you let everybody know what you think.
Yeah, it's possible that he was trying to get it out there, but still he at least has some plausible deniability doing it that way. What's more remarkable is his on-the-record interview where he frankly said that he almost resigned over Charlottesville, that the administration's not doing a good enough job at denouncing hate groups. I mean, that you would go on the record and say that about the president. I mean, again, these are uncommon times and lots of strange things have happened, but I think it's always useful to just take a step back and realize how dramatic and strange this all is, that the top economic advisor to the president is giving interviews saying this about his own boss, the commander-in-chief. I mean, it certainly suggests that there are serious divisions. And by the way, one quick thing I would mention is that we're heading into a month where there are a lot of serious major legislative battles that actually have to be fought, you know, to avoid government shutdown, to raise the debt ceiling, to you know, these are not, these are, this is not optional legislation. This is how to keep the lights on and keep the government running. And I think those divisions are only going to get deeper that we've seen in the administration as we kind of enter what Steve Bannon called the meat grinder month. There's going to be a lot of, you know, high stakes, high pressure negotiations. I'm guessing a lot more leaks are going to be coming. And we may not see all the same faces in the White House by the end of this upcoming month that we do right now.
Well, the strategy for passing most of these things, such as tax reform, is essentially a party line vote. I mean, they're not doing anything to cultivate potential Democratic support.
Sure.
So while you're spending all of your time fighting your allies, who you can't afford to lose any of them, as happened on health care, I mean, if there is a strategy here, I don't see it. It looks like a strategy. It looks like an intentional effort to undermine yourself and not get any legislation passed.
Well, right. And maybe it actually literally is a deliberate strategy. I think that some people have speculated to me that Trump would actually be much happier with enemies in Congress to fight against, that it would actually be better for him if his own party lost at least one chamber of Congress, so that he could have a more natural foe on Capitol Hill.
That's the craziest idea I've ever heard, by the way, because if he loses the House, seven committees start investigating him immediately. They immediately start impeachment proceedings. And I think it becomes overwhelmingly likely that the Democrats will impeach him because he's given them such solid constitutional grounds to do it. So, I mean, better off, defined better off, like he can have someone to blame, but he'll be impeached.
Well, and look, I don't know if I necessarily buy this, but I think there's also, you know, we have seen time and time again that Trump is most content in kind of, you know, bare-knuckled war, right? He's clearly not interested in policy details. He hasn't gotten anything passed. He very well might not. To have the House of Representatives to kind of beat up on and go to war with every day on Twitter and send his surrogates out, you know, into war on cable, I don't know. Look, like I said, I don't know what his thinking is here, but he's not doing anything that a president normally would to maintain a very kind of fragile majority in Congress. He's constantly picking on Republicans that aren't nice enough to him. I could see Trump, you know, kind of feeling like he's in his element in that situation. And like you said, the House might impeach him, but as long as Republicans are holding on to the Senate, it doesn't mean that he'll actually be ousted from office.
Just as a last member of the cabinet who seems to be creating some distance from Trump, Defense Secretary Mattis, there's this Facebook video which, like the Gary Cohn thing, doesn't seem like it was intended to become public, but maybe was intended to become public,
right,
where he's speaking to the troops and he's saying, we in the military have to hold the line until the rest of the country gets back to respecting each other. I forget his exact words, but it was essentially a pretty clearly pointed comment at the way Trump's been governing. Did you read it that way?
Yeah, I did. I also think that Mattis is one of, you know, a handful of, maybe more than a handful of, you know, legitimate public servants, whatever you think of their ideologies or their records, who's trying to, you know, sees his job in the Trump administration as averting catastrophe. He's trying to keep things running, trying to advise a president who maybe seems unadvisable. But I guess the question for a lot of these folks now is, and like we've been talking about, we've seen it come up more and more, you know, what do these guys do? Do they get to a point where they feel like this president is not teachable, he's not interested in learning, he's not interested in taking good advice, and do they jump ship? You know, it's not impossible. It's hard. I don't know Mattis very well. People who do tell me that he is a very patriotic person, and he's not going to just quit for the publicity of it or to save his own reputation. But there might come a time where people like Mattis just don't feel like they're doing any good in the administration, and they might as well get out now and and wash their hands of this whole kind of mess.
In the other direction, do you think it's possible that they see themselves as a kind of secret committee to save the world, that they're getting together and figuring out how to be a backstop against Trump, and that when the history of this period is written, there are going to be a lot of meetings among these people where they're talking about how to prevent this guy from creating nuclear catastrophe?
Well, sure. It's
it's a hunch. Nobody knows. Nobody's reported on this, but it's a plausible suspicion, and it's happened before. You know, at the end of the Nixon administration, it's something that if you were a patriotic military person in this role, would sort of fall to you. So it's people are positing it. We don't have evidence of it, but I find it quite plausible and heartening.
I find it heartening too, although not to be the like relentless pessimist here, but there is. I also have a concern about, and my colleague at The Atlantic, David Frum, has written about this and talked about this. But I worry about the long-term implications of military leaders and administration officials kind of working together behind the commander-in-chief's back to prevent, world catastrophe. I mean, obviously, that's good. World catastrophe is bad. But also, we do have, our Constitution is formed in a way that it does not, we're not really supposed to have these people running the country behind the elected president's back. And I hope that if something like that is going on, look, maybe these conversations are ultimately benign and it's responsible people working together to try to keep the train on the track. But I hope that it doesn't create this kind of system where the next president and the one after that, the so-called grown-ups in the room can kind of wield all the real power and let the president just kind of be a figurehead. I think that would be a bad legacy among many bad legacies left by this administration.
Last question, McKay. Why didn't Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, feel compelled to do the same thing that Gary Cohn and Rex Tillerson did? I mean, once he has these guys for cover, he said Trump can't fire everybody. I was expecting some, and he's Jewish too. This all embrace of white supremacists and anti-Semites is, you've got to at some level affected him, but he didn't. He passed up the opportunity to put any daylight between himself and the president.
Well, right, and I mean, look, we haven't talked about it that much in this conversation, but it's also possible that there are people like Mnuchin who maybe feel like they are getting good work done in their current job, right? That the president is the president, Trump is Trump, but in their jobs, they're making decisions and doing work that's, advancing whatever ideological agenda that they have. They feel like they're doing good work, and they would rather not, pick a fight with the president of the United States, even over something as important as Charlottesville, that they feel like ultimately their small voice in that situation and whatever satisfaction they'd get from that is outweighed by the good that they could do in their current posts. I mean, that's the case for basically maintaining the current status quo, and maybe all these people will still be here come, September or October.
I was going to say, or if you're Steve Mnuchin, you realize that no other president ever would have appointed you to Treasury Secretary, and you're still pretty grateful to the guy.
Well, it's possible too. There is some loyalty that comes from that.
I've been speaking to McKay Coffins. He's a staff writer at The Atlantic. McKay, thanks for joining me on the show.
Thank you.
That's it for today's show. But have you checked out Slate's podcast Represent? You should. Every week, smart, creative people join Slate culture writer and bright young thing Aisha Harris to discuss the latest films, TV shows, and happenings in Hollywood. You can download and subscribe Slate's Represent at slate.com/represent. Today's show was produced by Jason DeLeon. Thanks, Jason. I'm Jacob Weisberg. Thanks for listening to TrumpCast.